You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Rowan Conway. I'm Director of Innovation and Development here at the RSA, and I'm delighted to welcome you all here today for this special lunchtime talk. I'd really like to welcome our fantastic guest speaker today. Stephen Sloman is a Professor of Cognitive, Linguistic and Psychological Sciences at Brown University. He's the author of two books on cognitive sciences and currently editor-in-chief of the journal Cognition. His latest book, The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone, argues that we survive and thrive despite our mental shortcomings because we live in a rich community of knowledge. The key to our intelligence lies in other people and things around us. We're constantly drawing on that information and expertise stored outside our heads and in our bodies, our environment, our possessions, and in the community within which we interact. We don't even realise we're doing this, and it generally means we're not as clever as we think we are, is what I'm understanding from it. When I first started at the RSA, my role was as Director of Connected Communities, and so this particularly appeals to me, Stephen Sloman.
Thanks so much, Rowan. Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure to be in front of such a distinguished audience. Let me start with a little challenge. This is work by one of your country people, countrymen is the old term, Rebecca Lawson, who's at the University of Liverpool. She showed people a little image of a part of a bicycle and asked them to fill it out. So the challenge for you is, how would you fill it out? Where would you put the pedals and the chain, the rest of the frame? Most people find this harder than they think they will. Here's what one person drew. Be very effective if you had two sets of legs. So there are two pedals. Here's what someone else drew. There's at least only one set of pedals here, but it doesn't seem to turn much except the frame, and even if the chain turned, it wouldn't turn the wheels. Here's what someone else drew. This time they got the position of the pedals relative to the chain correct, but still not a very effective bike. A hard task. This is a good one if you have very long arms, perhaps effective for a chimpanzee. What's interesting about these images is even members of a local cycling club who cycled regularly, who fixed their own bikes, didn't do much better. An artist, Gianluca Gemini, picked up on this. He also had people draw bikes. The drawings were a little more elaborate, a little fancier, but no more effective as bicycles. What Gemini did was turn these into 3D images of bicycles, which he put up on the web. So despite appearances, this is not a real bicycle. It's a virtual bike created by Gemini. Very cool. I wouldn't mind owning it, but I wouldn't get very far on it. Right? I could go straight, perhaps, for a while until I fell over. It would be very hard to turn. So the point is, people have this image of things that are visible, even things for which the mechanism is visible. People have a feeling that they understand how these things work in a way that they just don't. In the case of toilets, it's as if we think we understand how a toilet works the same way a manual for a plumber might describe how a toilet works. What we actually know is that there's a handle you push down on, and if you're lucky, the water descends. So this has been demonstrated in the laboratory, the psychological laboratory, by a great psychologist named Frank Kyle and his students, like Leon Rosenblatt. And what they did was they asked people to rate how well they understood how various common everyday objects worked, like speedometers, sewing machines, toilets, helicopters. And then they said, okay, how does it work? And people thought and thought and didn't have very much to say. They realized they just didn't understand how simple things, even ballpoint pens, work. So later, when he asked them again to rate their level of knowledge, their understanding of the mechanism, it went down. So people themselves admitted that the question, the request to explain the mechanism by which these everyday objects work, punctured their illusion of understanding and made them realize they didn't understand as well as they thought that they did. So the claim here isn't that people are stupid. I mean, people may be stupid, I'm not going to argue for that, right? The claim is that people think they understand things better than they actually do. And there's a good reason for that. It's because things are really, really complicated, right? So here's a schematic of the parts of a refrigerator. There are lots of them, right? A modern car has approximately 30,000 different parts that are put together in incredibly intricate ways, right? So they minimize the vibration characteristics of the car and maximize the mileage, and right? There's a lot that goes into the design of every everyday object, even a ballpoint pen. So if you think about what is required to really understand a ballpoint pen, you've got to be a master. To really understand it, you'd have to be a master of material science. You'd have to be a master of fluid dynamics. You would have to be a master of economics to understand why ballpoint pens are as popular as they are. You'd have to be a master of hand kinematics to understand why they are the shape that they are. Things are complicated. In the biological world, things are really complicated, right? We've been talking about simple artifacts, things created by people. Things created by nature are much more complicated. This is the Krebs cycle, also known as the citric acid cycle, and it has to do with how cells create energy from oxygen. Please don't ask me how it works, because I have absolutely no idea. But I can tell you one thing, it's really complicated. Frank Kyle did a study in which he looked at people who had just learned this in a class on organic chemistry, to the point where they could reproduce essentially this image that I have here. And then he asked them a year or two later how well they would do on a test of the Krebs cycle. And people had a sense that they would do well. It's like when you think back to when you were in university, you feel like you learned stuff, and you learned stuff that you've retained. Well, it turns out that when you ask people what they've retained about the Krebs cycle, this is the kind of thing they tell you. Right? I particularly like this, lemon. That's what they've retained. No idea. Something happens. Right? So this is about what I know of the Krebs cycle. Here's another response. There are two chemicals, ADP, but this is the beautiful, right? Magic. So there are implications here, I think, for our understanding not just of the natural world, but perhaps of the supernatural world to some degree. Turns out Americans aren't as knowledgeable as they think they are. About 25% of Americans don't know that the Earth revolves around the sun. I believe the Earth revolves around the sun and that the sun doesn't revolve around the Earth. Don't ask me how I know that, right? Because I've never perceived it directly. I sort of take it on faith, and yet I call it knowledge. Before you feel too haughty about this fact, you should know that similar questionnaires show that people all around the world are just as uninformed as Americans. And this isn't just a modern phenomenon either. So in 1943, only 25% of college freshmen knew that Abraham Lincoln was president during the Civil War. Right? A fact that, despite being across the pond, I assume you're aware of. Oklahoma State did a survey, and its Department of Agricultural Economics did a survey a few years ago, and they found that over 80% of Americans support the idea that GMO, genetically modified foods, should be labeled as such. They should be labeled as produced with genetic engineering. This seems like a perfectly reasonable thing to support, right? Until you find out that they also thought that foods containing DNA should have mandatory labels. So it makes you wonder what the thinking process was that led them to the first conclusion, right? Just in case you're unaware, it's hard to find foods that don't contain DNA. In the States, there's something called Twinkies, right, which probably don't contain DNA. I'm sure you have the equivalent here. Multivitamins. It's not easy to think of examples. So, this feeling that we understand things better than we do has become a real problem, I think, right? And it explains the heat and vociferousness of some of the debate that we see in politics. My sense is this is especially true on the other side of the Atlantic, where people can't even have Thanksgiving or Christmas dinner with some members of their family anymore, or if they do, they agree not to discuss politics. I suspect that's true to some extent in this country as well, although I'm sure it's done with a little more politeness. This has been observed for years. This is a quote. Most people think it was due to Mark Twain. My sources tell me it's due to Maurice Switzer. It is better to remain silent at the risk of being thought a fool than to talk and remove all doubt of it. And this has been noted by one of your countrymen, too, right? Churchill said the best argument against democracy is a five-minute conversation with the average voter. And another of your countrymen, Bertrand Russell, pointed out that this failure of understanding is one of the causes of extremism. The opinions that are held with passion are always those for which no good ground exists. So my colleagues and I decided to demonstrate this in the laboratory. And what we did was we took a bunch of issues. This was in 2012. And these were hot topics in 2012, and many of them remain hot topics. Whether there should or should not be a national flat tax, a cap and trade on energy tokens, a cap and trade program on energy tokens, whether there should be unilateral sanctions on Iran, these kinds of issues. And we ran through the procedure that Rosenblatt and Kyle had run. So we asked people how well they understood each of these issues, then we asked them to explain the issues, and then we asked them again how well they understood the issues. And here's what we found. That prior to explanation, people rated their understanding as sort of middling. After explanation, their bubbles were burst. Their illusions of explanatory depth, as we say, had been exploded, and they rated their understanding as lower. And not only that, but when we ask people what their attitudes are towards these issues, how confident they are in one position or another, they became less confident, they became less extreme by virtue of having their bubble of understanding burst. One way we can show this is by asking people how willing they are to act on their beliefs. So how willing are they to donate to an advocacy group in favor of their position? And what we found So we gave people a small amount of money and said they could either donate it to an advocacy group in favor of their position, against their position. Nobody did that. They could keep it for themselves, or they could turn it down. In other words, give it to the experimenters. Nobody did that either. Here's what they did do. So one group of people, instead of asking them to explain the issue, we asked them for their reasons, right? So what are your reasons for or against each one of these issues? And generating reasons is essentially what we do around the Christmas table when we're with our family or at the pub having a beer, right? We talk about our values. We talk about who told us that this is a policy I should support. We don't talk about the mechanism by which the policy is operative, right? Rather, we talk about our relationship to the policy rather than the policy on its own terms. And so when we ask people for reasons, what you see is not so surprising that the more extreme people felt before generating reasons, the more likely they were to donate to the advocacy group after generating reasons. But the group that generated explanations, they showed a flat line. That is, the most extreme people were just as willing to donate to the advocacy group as the least extreme people, right? It's as if by bursting their bubble, they thought twice about whether they should contribute to the advocacy group. So is ignorance justified in politics? Well, I think it is. Again, I'm not trying to call people stupid. We've seen that ballpoint pens are complicated. If we think about something like the Syrian conflict, Wikipedia tells me that there are at least 150 interest groups involved in the Syrian conflict. Think about the number of interactions among 150 interest groups, right? Each pair of them could have some interest in common or some conflict. So in fact, there's 2 to the 150 possible interactions. There's an enormous number of possible interactions in the Syrian conflict. We're not going to understand that easily, and we're clearly not going to solve the problem by dropping a bomb. Trump's next agenda item is to reduce taxes in the U.S. Talk about complicated. The U.S. tax code is over 74,000 pages, right? Even Obamacare is only 20,000 pages or so. It's really complicated. And we've already talked about the complications of biology. So people don't deal with complexity because we don't deal with detail that well. In fact, if you take a little flash drive, you could hold several hundred thousand copies of our book on that little flash drive. The brain, according to an estimate by a famous cognitive scientist named Thomas Landauer, only holds about 1/16th that amount of information, about 1 gigabyte, about 1/300th of the information my laptop can hold. So, in that sense, you can't expect people to deal with complexity because we can't deal with detail very well. That's just not what the mind is for. Now, there is some complexity even to the issue that I'm talking about. There are some things that really aren't so complicated, right? Thou shalt not harm. That seems pretty simple and straightforward, and I would condone such a belief. So it's not always the case that we have to do a complicated causal analysis to come to a conclusion. And there are some political issues which really rest on simple values, what we call sacred or foundational values, right? This is what drives people on issues like abortion, right? So on one side, you have people who think that life is sacred and by no means should you end a life and that a fetus has a life. On the other hand, you have people who think that a woman's freedom to choose is sacred, and that should not be violated under any circumstances. So on this issue, you really don't have to engage in complicated causal analysis in order to come to a view. So these are simple and important kinds of values. And I'm contrasting them to other kinds of issues, which I take to be the sort of bread and butter of political discourse. Issues like, should we spend money on infrastructure, right? It seems to me bridges are good, right, because of the consequences, because they allow you to get to the other side. Issues of trade really depend very much on what we think trade is going to get us. Healthcare is a great example of something where we really do care about the costs and benefits. So sometimes we just can't depend on sacred values because it's the costs and benefits that really matter. And when that's what we care about, we have to engage in this kind of complicated causal reasoning that we're not so very good at. Now, superficial causal reasoning is easy. Let me give you an example. So consider this sentence. Stephen admires Phil because he is so candid. Clearly, any native English speaker, and even most non-native English speakers, would say that he here refers to Phil, right? Stephen annoys Phil because he is so candid. Now, all I've done is change one verb from admires to annoys, and yet he now picks out Stephen instead of Phil. I would argue, and many psycholinguists have argued, that the reason for this is that he, the pronoun, picks out the agent of the sentence. So Phil is the cause of admiration, whereas Stephen is the cause of annoyance. And he. So in order to understand the meaning of he, we have to do this rather sophisticated causal analysis, but we do it quickly, naturally, automatically, without even thinking about it. So in that sense, we're good at causal reasoning. The problem is when complexity emerges, right? The way humans reason is to extend their actions, right? We think about cooking, and it's really hard to separate the act of cooking from thoughts about cooking. Where we go wrong is when we're dealing with the complexity that the world presents us with. Issues like political policy, human relationships, right? Terribly complicated, and how a toilet works. So one thing this implies is that we should find the illusion of explanatory depth. We should find that we can reduce people's hubris by asking them to explain when we're dealing with consequentialist issues like healthcare, and we do. But it also suggests that when we're dealing with issues like abortion, in which attitudes are based on sacred values, we shouldn't find the illusion, and we don't. So what people tend to do is fill in causal gaps with value commitments. And for the in the interest of time, I'm just going to give one example of this. So discourse about gay marriage has changed a lot in the past 8 to 10 years in the States, right? When Obama entered office, he wasn't willing to endorse same-sex marriage. By the time he left office, he was happy to. What I would like to suggest is that the change in opinion about gay marriage in the States is perfectly correlated with a change in the nature of the discourse. We've gone from talk about basic values to talk about consequences, right? What are the effects on kids of having two fathers or two mothers? It's a very different question than whether what the Bible says is right or wrong about gay marriage. And you can see that kind of shift in the opposite direction in Iran in their discussion of whether or not they should have nuclear weapons. So the implication of these ideas is that if we want to change the discourse about something, if we want to improve conversation, the challenge to us is to get the conversation not to be about us, but to be about the policies, the consequences of the policies that we're talking about. Finally, let me address this question of why it is that we suffer from this illusion of explanatory depth. What is it about people that causes them to think they understand things better than they do? And the answer I'd like to suggest is that we suffer from it because we fail to distinguish what other people know from what we know. So other people understand cap and trade in carbon emissions. I may not, but the fact that other people do makes me feel like I do. It's a kind of knowledge conflation. We conflate other people's knowledge with ours. And as a result, when we're thinking about the mind, instead of thinking about it as something that happens between the ears, we should think about it as something that happens within a community, because we depend on each other's knowledge to a great extent. To get this idea across, let's think about it from the opposite direction. So far I've claimed that that we think we know things by virtue of other people knowing things. What's easier to think about is how we think other people know things because we know things. So here's a simple example of that. If you tap a tune, right? And then, so you think of a tune, you tap it out, and then I ask you, what's the probability somebody else will be able to tell you what tune you've just tapped out? Most people think, you know, it's not guaranteed, but anyone who knows the song has some chance of figuring it out. Well, let me tell you, nobody's going to hear the song that you're tapping out. There's just not enough information there. You think they'll know it because it's playing in your head. It's completely available to you. It's obvious and clear. All they hear is a bunch of taps on a desk or a table. So we tend to think other people know what we know, right? There's a phenomenon in cognitive psychology called the hindsight bias, which is a perfect example of this, right? So if you ask an American whether they knew that Hillary's campaign was a dud prior to the election. After the election, most people say, well, yeah, of course it was obvious it was a dud, and they'll give you some reasons. Let me tell you, I had no idea her campaign was a dud, and I was surrounded by Hillary supporters who thought she was doing just fine. In fact, that's what the polls told us. Here's a little study I did with a student at Brown named Nat Rabb, which shows the direction that I was originally talking about, how knowing that other people understand things make us feel like we understand. So in this experiment, we invented a bunch of phenomena, scientific phenomena. So in this example, we invented the phenomenon of glowing rocks. And we told people that the scientists who discovered them have not yet explained them. Okay? They don't yet understand how these glowing rocks work. How well do you understand them? And people gave the natural response, I don't understand them at all. Because they don't. They were just introduced to them. Consider this other condition. Everything's the same, but in this case, we say, the scientists have thoroughly explained how these growing rocks work. They fully understand how they work. How well do you understand how they work? And here are the data. So the first thing to notice is, nobody has a great sense of understanding here on a 1-7 scale. In one condition, when the scientists don't understand, their judgments aren't much higher than one, right? But when the scientists do understand, their judgments are almost twice as large, right? It's just a little bump. They're not saying, oh, I fully understand glowing rocks, but they have a sense of understanding that they didn't have before. Imagine if 100 people around you are saying, I understand why Hillary is crooked, right? Or I understand how the economy will benefit if Britain leaves the European Union. Presumably, if you have all of those people and people close to you, you're going to have a sense of understanding yourself. We've shown the same thing with policies. I'm not going to go through this, but we took a bunch of policies and we said either experts understand or they don't, and we found exactly the same effect. So the idea is that we depend on others, right? And we gain a sense of understanding from others because we're all in it together. Because there's a division of cognitive labor such that I know my little bit, I contribute my little bit, and you contribute yours, and all together we do great things. And we do great things, right? I mean, we get to the moon, and we build laptops and iPhones and incredible cathedrals in Milan. Right? Which, by the way, took almost 600 years and had about 75 chief engineers. I mean, talk about divisions of labor, right? Clearly no individual was going to create something close to this. A natural question to ask is, who are the members of our community of knowledge? Are they just other people? Is the internet a member of our community of knowledge? Here's an experiment by Adrian Ward in which he first asked people questions like, what's the best-selling beer in the U.S.? Anybody know what the best-selling beer in the U.S. is? Bud Light, that's right. It's almost as good as water. And then he divided the people up into two groups. So one group searched the internet for answers to these questions, and the other group didn't. And then both groups predicted their performance on an unrelated quiz. That is, a set of questions that had nothing to do with the first set of questions that they were asked. And what he found was that those who had searched the internet predicted that they would perform much better on the second test than those who hadn't searched the internet. They were sort of pumped up by the availability of knowledge that made them feel like they knew things. They also, as a result, felt like they had better memories and were better thinkers, simply by virtue of having been able to answer a bunch of questions using the internet. So I don't want to argue that that human beings and computers are the same thing, that they contribute equally to the community of knowledge. In fact, they don't. And what this video showed you was a very, very cute child who was able to read the intentions of an adult who had a problem to solve. And the child went, and very young child, 2 to 3 years old, who solved the problem for the adult, because the child could read the adult's mind. They could figure out what it is that the adult was trying to do. This is something that no other species can do. Chimpanzees can't do this. Computers certainly can't do it. They can't share intentionality, which is Mike Tomasello's term for this. So there's clearly a difference between people and computers. But nevertheless, we should be wary of what the web offers. Here's a study that Adrian Ward did of doctors and nurses. He asked them about people who search the site that has answers to medical problems before they come to see the doctor. And what he found is that they perceive their knowledge to be much, much higher than those of non-searchers, but what they actually know is pretty much the same of people who haven't searched the web to find the solution to their medical problem. So, in conclusion, I don't think the answer to this problem is education, right? Or it's not simply education. What I'm talking about is a basic aspect of human psychology, something that's true of Americans and British people and liberals and conservatives, that's true of everyone. And we can't just educate our way out of it. There are other kinds of things that we can think about. So in the world of financial decision making, there's a lot of evidence that if you want to get people to, say, save for their retirement, which most people think is a good idea, the way to do it is not to teach them about the benefits of saving, but rather at the point of decision to give them the requisite information to get them to invest, right? This is called just-in-time education. There are important implications for leadership here, right? That the value of a leader is proportional to their ability to use the community to find solutions to problems. So ignorance may be bliss. And the truth is, illusions can be pretty nice too, right? Voltaire said that. Illusions are the first of all pleasures. But they can be problematic. They're problematic when my sense of understanding, like my sense of understanding who to vote for, is based on the understanding of the people around me, and their sense of understanding is based on the understanding of the people around them, so that in essence, there's no real understanding, and we're all voting based on a house of cards. I love the way Robert Armstrong put this in a recent review of our book that he wrote in the Financial Times. We imagine ourselves as rugged cognitive individualists, growing our own intellectual food and living in mental houses built with our own hands. This is a dangerous error. Thanks.
That's fascinating. I know a fair few of rugged cognitive individualists. I enjoy their company enormously, but I'm going to bring to them that we need to divide our cognitive labor, because that's what I've come away from this with. It seems to me that your key point is that we never think alone, and that collective intelligence is the property much wider than individuals or heroes or single thinkers. So there are, you covered in your presentation, implications for politics and broadly for education. But what are the implications for teams or for networks? How do we need to work differently to the way that we might be currently working in order to optimize this collective intelligence or to use it wisely?
So a lot of teams are very effective, right? My sense is that the most effective teams are the ones that show some empathy, are able to work together, understand what other members of the team are thinking. But I think the real trick is to know what you don't know, right? So what we do know is right in front of us. It's something that we can't help but attend to. What's much, much harder is to know what we don't know and what information we can find in the people around us. It's actually shockingly hard for people to do that, right? People have a tendency to feel responsible for all knowledge if it touches on their area of expertise at all. And, you know, that's hubris. And if we can let go of that, I think we'd do much better.
It's kind of fundamental changing in the way we think about ourselves so that we can share that intelligence.
A little bit of intellectual humility goes a long way.
I shall take that along away with me. I'm interested when you were talking about shifting the political discourse and actually the illusion of explanatory depth. We are running a program here at the RSA called the Citizens Economic Council, which is trying to understand how decision making can be informed by a wider range of inputs. I'm interested in how that just-in-time education, or that just-in-time bringing those things, ideas into public discourse. How would you bring these two ideas or two worlds together? How do you bring just-in-time into the public discourse?
So there's a great book by Dick Thaler and Cass Sunstein called Nudge. And the first thing I do is read that book. It's they discuss a philosophy that they call libertarian paternalism, which sort of sounds like a contradiction in terms. But the idea is that when people make a decision, there's always some route that has to be followed in order to make the decision. So when we're voting, there are rules by which we vote. And if we're choosing ice cream, then there's some what they call architecture of choice that is made available by the ice cream store. And any good marketer knows that how you shape that architecture can make a huge difference to the final decisions that people make. So what Sunstein and Thaler argue is that as a society, what we should be doing is deciding what it is people really want. And this, of course, is a trick to do this fairly and in a way that satisfies everybody's interest. This is the notion of paternalism in their theory, that we should figure out what people really, really want. And that might require a little bit of paternalism. And then find out an architecture that'll push them in that direction. Right? It's libertarian in the sense that you never take choice away. This is critical. You never take choice away. And you also don't try to incentivize people. You don't pay people to do what you want them to do. Instead, you allow them to make free decisions, but you take advantage of what we know about behavioral science in order to help them to make the decisions that will make themselves themselves happier. That's the idea.
So, I mean, I think it's interesting to look at which are those issues that are complex and need public debate and deliberation, and which are those that can be reduced to something as simple as I only need to know where the toilet flush is and that the water comes down. I don't need to know how a toilet works. So similarly, in some of our kind of public debate, you can reduce some things and their complexity, but then others, we need to bring out the complexity through political dialogue. That comes into that question that you were talking about that I was referring or thinking about echo chambers when you talked about, with hindsight, we all think Hillary was doing a terribly bad job. But actually, the political discourse didn't get us to that during the campaign. So how might public debate have actually brought those issues to the fore?
Well, if we could have gotten outside of our echo chambers, then presumably there would have been a little more cross-pollination of ideas, and we wouldn't have all, you know, on every side of the fence, we wouldn't have all fed each other's prior beliefs, right? We would, you know, the one way to talk about what we're arguing is that human beings, rather than being rational processors of information, are channels of their communities, right? So our community has a belief, and we tend to just channel that. We don't think things through. But I think that, you know, this is a basic fact about people. We're not going to overcome it for the most part. And so we have to work within the scope of that understanding. So what this implies is we have to respect expertise, right? We have to find a way to figure out who knows, who has the information we want, and we have to find a way of getting at it in a way that avoids the expert's self-interest.
So So bring back the experts. It's a challenging time to do that. Any questions from the audience? We have a couple of... Okay, so we'll start with the gentleman there.
Hi, just putting in our last point. How would you say this relates to mastery? So obviously, so my boiler broke last week. And someone came around in 2 hours and fixed it. I stared at it for half an hour and had no idea what to do with it, and they quickly fixed it. There's master plumbers that have a mastery of those mechanics, and we can translate that and transpose that for anything. Are there signs of that, like ideas of flow and things like that, when people are in a flow state, that they are actually have gone deeper than the surface knowledge? And there are people, obviously, you can call them experts, that have an authority through consistent inquiry, skill, practice, that are more potentially more valuable and need to be recognized as such.
So when it comes to people who fix boilers, a flow state, demonstrations of mastery, it makes a lot of sense, right? You see this in athletes. So you can tell when an athlete is a master by virtue of the way they move. I think it's important to distinguish domains in which we can identify ground truth, right? So very few people would argue that there isn't a right answer to how your boiler works. From domains in which it's much harder to identify ground truth, right? Like, should Britain leave the EU? Well, experts disagree about that. And on any issue of sufficient complexity, you're going to get a lot of disagreement among experts. And on those same issues, I think that what you're calling a flow state is often misleading. So there's data. David Dunning at the University of Michigan has shown that the people who are most confident in their political beliefs tend to know the least, right? We have graduate students like that. When graduate students enter the department, they often sort of strut around as if they're experts. It takes decades to learn that you don't know anything. So unfortunately, I think the really difficult issues are ones in which expertise is hard to gauge.
Doesn't our general lack of understanding serve politicians and governments rather well? If we understood too much, we probably wouldn't be able to choose who to vote for, and we wouldn't be as docile.
Well, if you choose the right person, then I'd have to agree with you. If you choose some of our elected leaders, then... I'm not sure that I would. So I'm not sure docility is the answer here. I think the right answer is actively trying to determine true disinterested expertise. Yeah, I'm all for activity, not docility.
How about interested disinterest in a sense of, rather than thinking about expertise, thinking about diversity?
Absolutely. So, diversity is a terrific way to achieve excellence. It's actually necessary, I think, to achieve true excellence, as long as it's treated as a means to achieve excellence. I am certainly not one to argue that we shouldn't be interested, active participants in political life who try to understand things. That's the last thing I'm trying to argue. What I'm trying to argue is that we should admit the limits of our ability to do that, and respect those who have something to offer. So remember, in my mind, diversity is about everything. It's not just about diversity of, class or race. It includes diversity of political perspective.
Thank you. Very interesting. I'd like to pick up on the phrase about just in time and see whether there's more to it than time, about sort of fitting appropriately. I was a science teacher and was always worried about the lack of long-term understanding. So I started a sort of evening event in a wine bar where I don't teach science, but I invite people to ask questions about things that they're interested in, and then we see how the discussion goes. And one consequence is that you find out what it is that's motivating and interesting a person, even from, say, the Krebs cycle, which we touched on last month, the metabolism. You can judge where to go by what people are asking, how they express their interest. So it's, when you refer to being a bit paternalistic, there is another aspect, perhaps, of listening carefully to where people want to find things out. And then my own experience is that people become much more interested in and motivated to find out more when they've set the terms, as it were.
Thank you. Yeah. So by just in time, all I was referring to there was there have been lots of attempts to get people to make better decisions. And this was an example about financial decision-making. But this has been true in other domains as well, in which you try to educate people about the value of compounding, for instance, right? Like, it turns out that investing at a young age is a really good idea because the investment increases exponentially. And, you know, that's useful knowledge, but it turns out to have very little effect on people, in part because they forget it, or they never really understood it in the first place. What does make a difference is if you want people to invest in a retirement program, then do something like make it a default so that they have to make a decision to get out of the investment program, right, as opposed to making them make a decision to get into the investment program. So all I was referring to by just in time is if your intervention is at the point of the decision, it's going to be much more effective than if it's background education. So I don't think it's inconsistent with what you're suggesting at all. In fact, my co-author, Phil Fernbach, and I had a piece in the New York Times recently about the role of ignorance in our election and how we should reduce our hubris and respect the views of others. And one response we got was from a law professor who has been studying people who counsel others about their investments. And the first piece of advice you're given, in the States anyway, is to read disclosure statements, right? If you're investing in a company, then know that company, read the disclosure statements. So these people have been giving this advice for decades. It turns out that the experts themselves don't read disclosure statements. They rather get a sense, according to this woman, they rather get a sense of, you know, what the community thinks about this investment, and that's where they put their money.
My only concern with what you've been saying so far is the fact that things like capitalism don't really want their population to be that educated. So there is always going to be a divorce between education and what people know how to survive in this world. Because as soon as people have more knowledge, things like capitalism will start to not work so well. Same with the church as well. Soon people have more knowledge of their life and interests and other life around us. These organisations tend to crumble as a single entity. So I just think that has to be sort of touched upon why we have such bad education in the first place. I think that has to be addressed because it's very important. Thank you.
First of all, I wasn't arguing against education. I was just saying it's not going to solve these particular problems, right? That people have hubris, and if you want to change local decision-making, then there are better ways to do it. I guess one virtue of feeling that we live in a community of knowledge and that we're all very local experts is that I can plead ignorance to what it is that determines the fall of capitalism and whether capitalism is falling.
Thank you. Problem solving. Knowledge versus process. I know or I can. Which wins?
I think those two are harder to separate than you're suggesting. I think much of our knowledge is in the form of rules about correct process, right? So you know, let's take the extremes. An athlete, a great athlete, presumably knows the process. They're going to have a lot of knowledge about the activity, too. It's true that they can't necessarily articulate that knowledge. They may have no conscious access to that knowledge, whereas a really good coach may not be able to perform, but may have great access to the knowledge. It seems to me that we're really sort of talking apples and oranges. They're flip sides of talking about the same thing, right? So the coach who has access to the knowledge also has the skill of articulating it, and that's a process. So I'm going to deny your distinction.
Okay, the lady in the back.
Yeah, I'm tackling the issue of flaws in the system, with particularly with science and expertise at the moment. And one of the problems is that, there's lots of different flaws. I won't get into a whole list of them, but in particular, trying to access information in the science world is very cliquey and expensive to access. The scientists are very careful to keep closed minds on what the gaps in the information are. So if you actually even wanted to try and help to identify a gap in knowledge, you wouldn't even know where to look for. So to engage collective intelligence is practically impossible at the moment because of the way the whole system is set up. And if it was much more open and collaborative and participative, then that also helps moving forwards, because we can get away from more capitalism, and we could start to work towards evaluation and contribution as a different model.
I'm sorry to hear that you're encountering those difficulties. I would have hoped that the internet would have made that a lot easier. I know that the internet has made a lot of promises that have not come through, and instead of providing free access to knowledge, we have a bunch of cognitive bubbles and echo chambers. But in the context of science, I'm a little surprised to hear that. I mean, I find, so if I have a scientific question, I find resources like Wikipedia invaluable. I find it really easy at least to get basic facts really quickly for free. It's true that a lot of scientific knowledge is inaccessible, but a lot of it requires incredible expertise. It might take years of study in order to develop the language to discuss explanations for scientific phenomena. So, you know, I do think there is a place for scientific expertise. That's not something that's just going to go away.
So we've unfortunately gone slightly over time, so I do want to let you get back to your days. But before we do, many thanks to you and our online audience for such a fantastic conversation. Please can you join me in giving a big hand to our guest speaker today, Stephen Sloan.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.